All right, well, I think we're gonna get started. Thank you guys so much for being here and for being here early. My name is Jonah Walters. I helped organize this panel, and I think probably what I'll do is we're gonna speak in order, just write down the table, and I'll ask each of you to, you know, introduce yourselves, and maybe so as not to take up too much time here at the beginning. So what I'll do is I'll just take a few minutes, and I'll start timing myself. I'll just take a few minutes to introduce the panel, explain part of what motivated it, explain a little bit of my background and some of the work that I've been doing with others inside the discipline of geography, and then we'll move down the line, and we'll end up with time at the end. Hopefully we can have a discussion, you know, with all of you in the larger room. So like I mentioned, my name is Jonah. I'm a graduate student at Rutgers University in New Jersey, which is, of course, a big public university with both a large ROTC presence, a large military presence on campus in various ways, but then also a sort of a large-ish student activist presence that has been much larger historically. And sort of historically, a big piece of student activism at Rutgers, one big concern animating it was opposition to ROTC and opposition to military influence in research. And sort of the big story that's told a lot and is sort of part of the way that people think about the history of activism at Rutgers has to do with the formation of the campus where my department actually is, the Livingston campus at Rutgers, which came about as a result of especially Black and Puerto Rican student organizing against ROTC, but also against the influence of a very conservative social science departments. And that resulted in the creation of a campus which was meant to be specifically for ethnic studies, specifically for, there was a Department of Puerto Rican Studies at the time. And so all of that is sort of very much in the background of the work that I've been doing with some colleagues at Rutgers and in the sort of discipline at large to oppose military influence in the discipline of geography. So I'll steal a few minutes to speak about that here at the top. So there was sort of a big moment in the discipline about going on 15 years ago, unfortunately, 10 years ago certainly. In 2006 in geography, when there was sort of a disciplinary or a discipline-wide turn towards thinking really critically about the role of academic geographers in participating in military projects. And the event that sparked that consideration was something called the Bowman Expedition, which was a special research project that was conceived of through a collaboration between the Department of Geography at the University of Kansas, a civilian department, and then military geographers working at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. And this program sort of came about because there was a mutual recognition on the part of both civilian and military geographers. Ironically enough, having to do with the Iraq War, there was sort of this mutually agreed upon conclusion that the problem with the Iraq War was a lack of geographic knowledge in the armed forces. And so to, you know, pave the way for another decade of American war making, civilian geographers had a responsibility to contribute to the military and to contribute to the military's knowledge base. So the Bowman Expeditions were founded as sort of an aspirational project to place a team of civilian geographers to be faculty or grad student researchers in every single country in the world for a period of 9 months to a year, every single year. And these teams would sort of rotate out and would be producing maps, producing other kinds of knowledge in place. Obviously that has not quite come to fruition. There are Bowman Expedition projects in various countries around the world today. But a lot of that was sort of headed off by the fact that the very first sort of flagship project took place in Oaxaca and took the form of a sort of comprehensive spatial research project, which is very typical inside geography. So this was a team of North American researchers collecting parcel level spatial data for the creation of very, very detailed maps of communally held lands in Oaxaca. Communities that were participating in this project in Oaxaca discovered sort of 2 years into the research project, 18 months into the research project, that this was being funded through a $2 million grant from the US military, that the terms of that grant included an agreement to share all data collected with both the American and the Mexican militaries. And needless to say, these, you know, indigenous Oaxacans were extremely angry that was the case, and immediately requested that the researchers, first of all, leave Oaxaca, and second of all, destroy all the data they had collected. you would think that that would lead to a more comprehensive reckoning in the discipline about the influence of military objectives in our research practices. It didn't. It resulted in the end of that particular project, but there were some pushes to pass resolutions through our professional associations condemning that kind of thing, or even just censuring the professors most directly involved in that collaboration between the University of Kansas and Fort Leavenworth. Those resolutions didn't pass. The momentum that existed inside the discipline then sort of died on the vine. And that, like I said, was 10 years ago at this point. So I have sort of stepped into that with a number of other colleagues, younger people inside the discipline, to try to bring that that momentum back by calling for a principle of, or a binding agreement of principled non-participation with military agencies, most notably the DOD, that would apply to all academic geographers or all geographers working in academic departments, and that could be enforced through our professional association. And we've conceived of this potential agreement as something similar to agreements that exist inside the American Psychological Association. There's an agreement there that's binding that instructs professional psychologists not to participate in military interrogations. We can also point to similar oaths taken by architects not to design torture facilities, including including prisons that include solitary confinement facilities. There are several such binding agreements that exist in architects' professional associations now, and architects that design prisons often pay professional costs for doing so. So that's what we're pushing for right now, very much sort of in the early stages of getting that agreement across. But there have been meetings, there have been sessions discussing that a potential agreement like that at the past two large annual geographers meetings. It's the AAG, the American Association of Geographers, and we're continuing to push for something like that. I'll steal one more minute to talk about sort of a pedagogical concern, which I think has become a lot more present in the discipline, and I think across disciplines in social science, since 2006, when this conversation really started in a productive way in geography. And that has to do with training undergraduate students in specialized GIS skills. And I'm going to refer to GIS a lot, which is that's the digital mapping field inside geography. So there's a persistent anxiety inside geography that you hear a lot about if you go to these kinds of conferences, the geography conferences, about how the discipline is hemorrhaging majors, it's having a hard time attracting enrollment in its undergraduate level classes, that it's a sort of dying science that's quickly losing ground to sciences like sociology or economics or anthropology. To a certain extent, that's true. It's obviously greatly exaggerated. But the sort of saving grace for the discipline over the past 5 to 6 years has been the emergence of GIS as a subfield that's very much in demand amongst undergraduates, precisely because it positions you to capture really good jobs after college. And so almost every academic geography department in the country now offers certificates in GIS. Some even offer master's certificates in GIS, and these are really popular. In fact, there was a report issued by a professional association 2 years ago that, and I'll just quote it quickly, that says, despite negative growth trends for geography, bachelor's and master's degrees awarded in the fields of GIS and cartography have far outpaced those of all other social sciences and indeed all other disciplines. So this is a huge thing. And I think it's important for professional geographers and people inside higher education at large to be pointing out that the jobs that these graduates, people graduating with GIS certificates, often enter are military jobs or military adjacent civilian jobs. And despite geography's reputation for being sort of a home for critical social science, for Marxist and social science, there has been startlingly little discussion inside the discipline about the fact that one social function that our departments are increasingly filling is to provide extremely well-trained human inputs for military applications. And this wasn't an accident. The explosion in GIS instruction in academic geography departments started after the major, enormous software company, Esri, which creates commercial GIS software, began marketing their software, especially ArcGIS, which is their sort of flagship program, to the DOD and to major law enforcement agencies around the country extremely aggressively. And advocating that these agencies switch over from their proprietary mapping softwares and take on these commercially available softwares, which then allows them to hire people who have been trained in civilian institutions to use those commercial softwares. So I think I'm at 10 minutes, so I'll leave it there and pass it over to Sophia.
Thank you, Jonah, for putting this out. I think it's telling that we don't talk enough about the role of the military right now and trying to grapple where it's at. And I think that's sort of reflected in, you know, the folks in this room. But I kind of want to, my talk is going to be kind of going back and forth, I think, between where we're at right now and I think in broad strokes, some of the features of the resistance that came out of academia. I'm currently not in academia. I came from NYU, I'm a member of DSA, and I'm trying to refocus again on anti-militarism work. So I want to first talk about the crisis that the U.S. sort of faced in terms of in the fall of the Soviet Union, attempting to rejig U.S. imperialism, assert itself and its ability to intervene around the world. Of course, it came out, you know, the sole superpower. I think, largely buttressed by an entire ideological perspective that won out around the way the U.S. Has a right to intervene for humanitarian reasons, whether that's Yugoslavia, Rwanda, and Iraq. In Disciplining the Middle East, which is a book by two anthropologists, Lara Deeb and Jessica Winninger, they kind of go into the radicalization that happened among a key cohort of people who went into academia and graduate school that were radicalized around, first of all, the first Gulf War and the sanctions, and followed by the Second Intifada in Palestine, although the First Intifada in 1987 was also a key turning point for them. And they talk about how, today, Palestine, it's in the halls of Congress, you can go and organize at lobby days for Palestine. You have, you know, presidential candidates coming out against Israel and its aggression in Gaza. That, you know, defending people like Ilhan Omar against attacks from the right and attacks from Zionists. So in some ways, it's just very hard to grapple with the intense the censorship, the denial of tenure, which still happens for predominantly Arab and Muslim academics, but of course this was the climate, especially in the 90s, and this was a major radicalization for a cohort of people. In this book, they talk about it, how many they themselves couldn't write this book until they got tenure. So it's an ethnography of a cohort of people in the 90s and later in the 2000s who were both impacted by the ability, the way the U.S. Channeled funding and into the study of the Middle East, into Arabic, as part of the neocon project, a project for a new American century, that really pushed for, oh my God, sorry. That pushed for intervention in the Middle East, and that was enabled after 9/11, the attacks, to push for it in Afghanistan and Iraq. And they talk about how both it was the funding for it and the ability to actually radicalize during the movement against the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and around Palestine that really enabled a whole layer of them to gain the confidence to come out and join and organize for the academic boycott, and there was a series of victories around this, especially in 2013, whether that, you know, that was the American Studies Association, the National Association of Women's Studies, Chicanx Studies, and Indigenous Studies. There was a whole series of different academic associations, but it was only really through the process of the anti-war movement, the movement of students' justice in Palestine, that gave the confidence for a number of academics to actually be able to organize themselves as well. And of course, this was also a cohort that opposed the human terrain system, which was pushed for, which was essentially a project of the Pentagon to push for anthropologists to be embedded in the military in Iraq and to study, to provide, again, knowledge of the people that were under occupation. So I kind of go into that a little bit because I think that there was both, there were both clear sort of victories around that, and there are also some setbacks because, I mean, people can kind of disagree, but there was also a whole, the project of Islamophobia and the argument about how terrorism comes about and political violence was I think lost because we still have today the proliferation of radicalization theories that essentially say that a Muslim's kind of devoutness is you know and is the sign of a radicalization and a kind of a ticking bomb for them to commit terror attacks, and that was largely uncontested throughout this time, and still is. And I think what took place was when Obama came into office, promising to end the war in Iraq, didn't do so, expanded drone strikes and so on, and he also expanded the domestic war on terror in the U.S., which allowed for a massive project of human surveillance of Muslim communities, and initially this was, you know, there was both, FBI manufactured terror plots, the use of radicalization theories that were have been, you know, are just junk science that were promoted by the U.S. military, but also a really important kind of more insidious deepening of this, which took place in 2014 on. Known as Countering Violent Extremism. It was both in the U.S. and in the U.K. It's called PREVENT. That really came out of this notion that what we're doing something wrong with our counterterrorism programs. What we really need to do is address the root causes. And it was like the root causes of terrorism, which were, you know, the alienation of Muslims, but also the degree to which they're turning towards religion and their sort of alienation. What we really are doing wrong is that we're not essentially expanding the ability of the Muslim community to surveil itself. And so CVE became, it really deputized ordinary Muslims. It rallied together, I mean, you have to also remember this is in the wake of counter-revolution in the Middle East, the rise of ISIS attacks. And then there was this global coalition against ISIS. It was literally like, you know, the ruling classes of the world were like, let's set aside our differences and let's deal with this problem that we all have. And so they internationalized the war on terror in lots of ways and used it to be able to clamp down on mass movements in these different countries, whether that was in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, you go down the line, UAE, everyone had their own war on terror against organizers, activists, any kind of movements, and clamped down hard in the name of fighting terrorism. And we still have that to this day. And so CVE really, in the U.S. especially, drew together. It was insidious because it said, well, what we really need to do is work with the Muslim community. And essentially, it was kind of the template that U.S. police departments used during the height of kind of crime and the war on drugs in the 80s and 90s, just to say, let's organize with church leaders in the black community and really clamp down on drugs and gangs and so on, and have a very like harsh law and order approach. But it was sort of the same template of, we need to work with the community to take on this problem. In the context of the Muslim community, this means you pull together healthcare professionals, social workers, teachers, civic leaders, mosque leaders to say, listen, we all have a problem with Muslim youth. They're going online, they're getting all these ideas. Let's all work together, you know, and in insidious ways so that when you had mental health professionals, therapists, essentially being told to be on the lookout for any signs that somebody was close to being a terrorist, essentially, which meant like it could have been anything. You could have been frustrated with U.S. foreign policy. You could have, you know, and any range of reasons. And it has been an incredibly destructive way of policing the Muslim community, not without fight back. There's been some very important initiatives against countering violent extremism. A lot of people pointed out that this was a sort of a form of let's say welfare in certain ways. It was you had grants from the federal government going towards after school programs, social services, and so on, but they were funneled primarily towards Muslims for this very insidious process of surveillance, where if you signed up for these services, you would be on a list and monitored. And so a lot of Muslim activists and organizers were like, well, actually, we believe all of these services should be provided to every marginalized community, not on the basis of surveillance, but because we all actually need anti-poverty programs, need social services. And this is largely, I think, a marginal kind of, it hasn't been a kind of struggle that the US left has really paid a lot of attention to. But I think it is important when we're talking about the fight for social programs right now, that this was used as a way to surveil a specific population. I think in large part the Trump era has produced a really important wave of resistance. I think what Jonah's talking about speaks to that. You know, architects kind of being challenged about, you know, applying for bids to build a wall or to design walls, prisons, and so on. This is a hugely important moment to fight back. There is the STEM strike against the war machine pledge. A number of academics have signed on, which essentially says we're not going to work for the U.S. military or any military research, which is incredibly brave given how much of STEM research is tied to it. It's almost impossible, and it's not a coincidence that a lot of the people who've been leading that have been graduate unions, and I think that's the new curve of where we're in a moment right now in academia in terms of the challenge against the military is really, I think, going to be bound up in the ability of academic workers to see themselves as workers and to transform their own knowledge production. You see that with tech workers who, you know, maybe they don't identify necessarily as workers, but they do see that they're creating the surveillance that allows ICE raids to happen, and so they're questioning that. I think similarly, academia, there is a role to play, and I think now we're seeing a sense of not just sort of like a moral kind of a feeling that you don't want your research sort of taken, that there's an ethical problem, but also that you actually have a role because you help run your campuses. And I think that's going to be an important kind of thing that's generalized. You have organizations like Science for the People that are really trying to shift around these questions. At the same time, I think that these are still sort of, you know, I want to kind of draw out, these seem to be still very small. They're very, it's very encouraging that they're coming out, but there is still, I think, a question about where the U.S. military is headed. And again, when you think about, and I want to end on some level to kind of throw out a question, the U.S. military faced a serious problem before 9/11 because it couldn't get over the Vietnam syndrome in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. You couldn't actually have boots on the ground, you couldn't have troops on the ground for a very long time because people had a memory of what Vietnam was, and yes, it was distorted and there was all sorts of lies and arguments about what the anti-war movement represented and how it hated soldiers and so on. But there was a sense that you couldn't do that. I mean, you had Reagan, one of the most violent racist presidents in American history, and you could not actually pursue the kinds of full-on wars and interventions because it was too close to Vietnam and the defeat of the U.S., which was literally the only war the U.S. has ever lost. It was at the hands of both national resistance in Vietnam and an anti-war movement here and soldiers. I think when they got over that, it was really the building up steadily over the 90s of a justification for full-on war. I think the U.S. military is in an immense crisis right now, and you can kind of see that. This year, they've lost thousands of potential recruits, like in terms of their quota or their goal. They didn't meet it. It was thousands of soldiers thousands of recruits that they couldn't recruit because of a tight labor market. And so people aren't actually joining the military. It's a real problem for them. So when we're talking about, and then on top of that, Trump's own policies there's been massive opposition to some of that. Both, you know, in generally, where we have like Bernie coming out, the War Powers Resolution for the first time, being used to try to end U.S. support for a particular war in Yemen. It's very restricted. It doesn't challenge the U.S.'s own wars in the Middle East, but it's an important step forward. And then you have a, you know, you have a movement challenging U.S. support for Israel, which is the, you know, the largest recipient of military aid of any of its allies. These are very important historic steps forward. And then, of course, you have some opposition. I think you're seeing some opposition to, you know, there's a resolution around an end to U.S. aid to the Honduran government as a result of its violence against its own people, and the Berta Cáceres Act, which is also historic because Berta Cáceres was a militant and an activist in Honduras who was murdered on the watch of Obama and Hillary Clinton. It's important that this resolution has come forward. And then, of course, there's a debate. The U.S. wants to push for intervention in Venezuela, but there's also a massive problem in its hands over how to do that. But the consensus when you read the news is that the U.S. stands firm on its tensions with China, and it wants to push for something there. It's unclear how to do so, but it is the tariff wars are not just, you know, a product of the Trump administration. The entire ruling class is really, I think, united on how to take on China's rising economic power, its rising imperial ambitions, its alliances with Pakistan, its inroads in southern Europe, its inroads in Africa. This is a serious problem at the hands of the U.S. military, unprecedented since World War II. And I want to end there because I think really that it's trying to figure out how to pursue its military ambitions. And I want to raise the question of how academics have confronted this, because, I will just quote here: when Trump was entering, Secretary of Defense Mattis resigned, and a whole crew of people who had been part of the Obama administration and were their war hawks have kind of pulled back from the Trump administration, I think, in an attempt to regroup their own orientation around the U.S. military. But within that, there's some very interesting discussions happening about how climate change is a national security question. And this hasn't, to some degree, it's being confronted in some ways, but in others, I don't think people talk or think about what ramifications this has for the Green New Deal. Who will actually carry that out? It's I think the only organized force in the U.S. and the only template we have is FDR and the arms economy through World War II. It is the reference point of the U.S. left on this, and not just the U.S. left, but the European left, that FDR helped fight fascism and provide a Keynesian, you know, New Deal to end kind of, you know, fascist, the threat of fascism, but also to provide a solution to capitalism's crisis. Today, that those lessons are being brought back, but the question here again is the resolution of capitalist crisis came through a war in the 40s and 50s, and it's unclear, and the vehicle for that was the U.S. military in a large part, whether that came through housing, that came through some template of full employment and so on. The role of the U.S. military in the new Green New Deal will have to be the question, I think, that we have to confront. And that's just where I'm going to go at, because I actually think that it will be an enormously tempting project for the new left to say, well, maybe it's a good thing if we don't engage in wars, but the U.S. military has a role to play in rebuilding America and its industrial policy. And so then there's a question of how is that possible? And on what basis? This is the same U.S. military, again, that has gone through, you know, that has white supremacists in it, that has fed the racism that Trumpism represents, that is an extremely violent institution. The question of how you demilitarize then will become, I think, contested, because it is the one most organized force in the U.S. And I do think that it's actually making inroads in terms of making an argument that sustain it. It must, the military itself must invest in renewable energy so that it itself can be ready for combat in a more efficient way. And so I'll just throw that out there and kind of end it. It's a lot, but I'm excited to hear what others say.
Thank you. That was great. My name is John Lawrence. I teach psychology at the College of Staten Island, which is part of the City University of New York. And I'm active in my union, the PSC, and both Stuart and I are part of the International Committee, and I used to be part of the Committee Against the Militarization of CUNY, which morphed into the International Committee. So I wanted to tell the story how basically ROTC has been brought back to CUNY, and we've fought against that and had some successes and some failures. So I wanted to tell you about that story, basically. So ROTC, for those of you who don't know, is basically a college-based educational program for training commissioned officers in the military. So it's basically colleges collaborate with the military to host these programs on their campus and train future officers. There's basically two ways in which officers, or three ways that officers are trained. One are at the military academies, one at ROTC, which is the biggest educator of commissioned officers, and then through the people working themselves up through the ranks in the military. In 2011, the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy was repealed, or basically determined to be not constitutional. And so for the couple decades before that, people that were against military education on campuses were using Don't Ask, Don't Tell as the reason to keep military off campuses. They weren't saying the military is immoral or they're committing human rights problems. They were saying the military is discriminatory and that goes against our policies on universities, so we can't have a discriminatory institution as part of our campus. So when that was repealed, it opened up the possibility to bring ROTC back to campuses. And in 2013, the American Enterprise Institute wrote a position paper saying it's particularly important to bring back ROTC to campuses on the West and the East Coast, where they are kicked out during the Vietnam War due to student protest, because these campuses have such diverse population and we need our officer corps to be diverse, because we have bases all over the world, and we don't want to be looking like this white supremacist army. We want to be the face of the world. So CUNY is the most diverse university in the United States. And there's campuses where people come, they basically say in this position paper, there's 35% of people are from outside the United States that are going to like City College. And we need these people to be in our military, to be the face of the military. So we need to bring ROTC back. And so a number of us, faculty members, particularly people that were activists in the union, started to organize against this. We developed a resolution that was passed by our union on the reasons why that the university should not host ROTC on campuses. So I briefly just want to kind of give you the reasons why we believe that it's wrong for all universities to host military training. The basic purpose of the U.S. military is not defense, as I'm sure everybody in this room knows. The very basic purpose of the U.S. military is to project U.S. power around the world. And doing that, human rights violations is inherent in the project. So basically, we're training people that we know are going to be put into positions that they're going to have to commit human rights violations. And so our number one argument was, that's wrong, we shouldn't do this. And I just wanted to read you this quote that really well states the purpose of the U.S. military. So I'm sure y'all are familiar with George Kennan. He was the primary architect of the Cold War. And in a secret document in 1948, planning for the Cold War, and he basically says, quote, "We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only about 6.3% of its population. This disparity is particularly great as between ourselves and the people of Asia. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise patterns and relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity without positive detriment to our national security. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We need not deceive ourselves that we can afford today's the luxury of altruism or world benefiction. We should cease to talk about vague and, for the Far East, unreal objectives such as human rights and the rise of living standards and democratization. The day is not far off when we are going to have to deal with straight power concepts. The less we are then hampered by idealistic slogans, the better. So that's a pretty good summary of U.S. foreign policy for the last 70 years, right? And that's when we ask our students to join the military, we're asking them to take up that goal. The second major reason that the Union opposed supporting ROTC was that joining the military is bad for the health of people that join the military. So there's people that came back from the Iraq and Afghanistan war. At least 20% of them had post-traumatic stress disorder, just a little less had traumatic brain injuries. Now about 35% have applied for some sort of disability. And then even when you come back, the psychological consequences for having participated in war weighs heavy on people. And more Iraq and Afghan veterans are now dying of suicide than died in the war. So the last study I read, which is a couple years ago, I'm not sure that up to date, but over 20 people in those two wars commit suicide every day in the United States. Also, a big risk for women who join the military is sexual assault and sexual harassment. So in epidemiological studies, 25% of women who join the military report being sexually assaulted at one time, 50% report being sexually harassed. And in the military, there's no independent judicial system for dealing with sexual assault. So it happens under the auspice of your commander. So if your commander is buddies with the person that committed sexual assault, that person is not going to be held accountable. And it's very rare for people to be held accountable for sexual assault in the military. Another big health risk for people that join the military is exposure to environmental toxins. So I'm sure you've heard of Agent Orange, and kind of the Agent Orange equivalent in the Iraq and Afghanistan war is being exposed to burn pits. Around camps across both war zones, in order to deal with all the refuge and waste, the military was creating these huge burn pits where they'd just throw anything that went into the burn pit to get rid of the waste. And it was obvious to probably everybody but them that it was toxic. And now these people are having serious environmentally caused all sorts of disorders. So another big issue related to this is informed consent. So in doing research in a university, the concept of informed consent is essential to the ethics of doing research. That when you agree to be a participant in research, it's incumbent on the researcher to inform the person who's the participant about all the possible costs and all the possible benefits of participating. But we don't hold the military to the same standard when they recruit people. The military literally spends $3 or $4 billion a year to convince people to join the military, and it's a sales job, right? They use the same exact techniques that people use when they're trying to sell you cars, and they don't talk to you about the fine print, the risk, or the history of it, or the ethical or moral risk. That basically violates the whole concept of informed consent, which is key to to the production of information, which is the goal of universities. Another big issue is academic freedom. You can't have academic freedom in the context of a ROTC program. Military is a hierarchical organization in which you cannot question the goals of the organization. So in a ROTC program, to form a ROTC program, you need to have basically somebody from the military has to be made a professor inside the context of the university. So there's basically the university carves out an exception. There's a rigorous process for deciding who's going to be a professor and who's not going to be a professor, and these military personnel are excluded from that process. Now we can argue whether that process is just also, but that's not the point right now. And that military person can't start questioning the purpose of the military, or start talking about human rights violations by the military, and the cadets in the program also couldn't do that. So that basically slices out a whole part of the university that can't hold to standards of academic freedom that are crucial for the whole purpose of the university. With these objections to ROTC, we worked to stop ROTC. In 2013, working with the military, the CUNY proposed a plan in which they were going to introduce ROTC at 4 different campuses across the city. The City College, York College, which is in the Bronx, Medgar Evers College, which is in Brooklyn, and on my campus at the College of Staten Island. So as faculty, we organized to try to stop this. And what one kind of point where they were vulnerable is they had to get at least one department that would partner with the military and basically take ROTC as a sub-program under their department. And two, they had to get the academic program of ROTC approved by the Faculty Senate. Basically, the curriculum had to be approved by the university. So we organized to try to stop both these things from happening. And we were successful at 2 campuses, but we weren't successful at either York campus or at City College. And the way we did it at both Medgar Evers and College of Staten Island is that we organized large forums in which people could come and talk about whether they're for or against ROTC and had a big discussion. And basically at CSI, they couldn't find any department that would be willing to host the ROTC program. And at Baruch, their faculty senate just voted down affiliating with the curriculum. Our problems at the other 2 colleges was, one, the big apple in their eye was trying to get City College. That was what they really were shooting for, and they got it. And I think part of that, there was also at the same time, the social science department was named after Colin Powell. And Colin, you all know who Colin Powell is, right? So Colin Powell got together a bunch of people that donated $10 million to the college, and Colin Powell, he wasn't like the leader of bringing ROTC back, but he was like, now that he's like their model person of who's someone who came up from ROTC, they named the social sciences department after him, and he just talked up ROTC. And we just couldn't get enough faculty members at the City College to speak against that kind of that propaganda onslaught. And then Another big lesson learned was we had trouble organizing students to oppose militarism. So some students spoke out, but a lot of students came out and spoke for, you know, ROTC. They were seeing it as a possible opportunity for themselves. And so that was a big lesson learned, is if you really want to keep ROTC off these campuses and keep militarism off these campuses, we need a well-organized student body that basically refuses to have it on campus and refuses to participate. So we have a lot of organizing to do and teaching people about militarism and its adverse effects. And I think I'll leave it off there.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks, John. So I'm Stuart Davis. I teach in the Communication Studies Department at Baruch College. And like John, I'm active in the Professional Staff Congress, and particularly in the International Committee of the PSC, which is like kind of our sort of anti-war, anti-imperialism, solidarity type wing of our union, which is pretty unique, I think, to these teachers' unions that I know of, so I'm proud to be a part of it. Before I get started, I want to thank my fellow panelists, Sophia, Jonah, John, particularly Jonah, for coming up with this idea, because this is something that I wasn't surprised to see, but within my very narrow kind of like academic slash activist world, this seems like not necessarily a priority for a lot of people, so thank you. And thank you guys for coming, because yeah, this is something that's really important. So I'm gonna talk briefly about a project that might have launched, might not have launched, we think launched, because it's a CIA, last year at my university called the Signature School. It was started, so I found out about this in February of 2018. When I got an email from a colleague of ours in the PSC, Manny Ness is his name, and he said, hey, did you guys know that you're sponsored by the CIA now? And apparently there was a press release on the Baruch homepage that announced this relationship of a signature school between Baruch and the CIA. And I'm gonna talk about in detail, some as much detail as I have, about what a signature school is, but I just wanted to kind of foreground with the idea that this was not done in consultation with faculty at all. The first time most faculty outside of very specific people working on the signature school found out about it was literally from the school's webpage. So immediately a group of us within Baruch who are kind of involved in fields like anthropology, history, fieldwork intensive fields, and other individuals, including a guy who's very active in Veterans for Peace, and he was in the Vietnam War and is now staunchly anti-war, anti-imperialism, and as well as people in the PSC, we got together and started to think about kind of what do we do now? What is this? Like, how do we kind of, where do we start? So the first thing we did was we eventually, after a couple months of pushing and pushing and pushing, got the Memorandum of Understanding, which describes what the signature school was. It took us about 2 months to get that. And we got it, I think, originally leaked by a colleague within the school who was responsible for it. The president eventually released it put it on the webpage. But a signature school, in the kind of general sense, seems to be an attempt to rehabilitate the CIA's image, right? To kind of put a positive sort of spin on this new CIA, kind of similar to what John was talking about with the new U.S. military. It's the CIA that's no longer about, you know, killing people in, you know, the so-called global south. It's about bringing them in. It's about changing our face. And obviously the strategic value there would be that they could also speak, you know, key languages that would work with the CIA. But explicitly in the Memorandum of Understanding, the idea was to create basically a permanent presence for the CIA within one of our schools at Baruch, which is the Marx School of International Affairs. And that would include, and this is again from quoting the MOU, conducting on-campus interviews, information sessions, workshops, simulations, couldn't figure out what that meant, and networking activities with student organizations, honor societies, and charters of diversity organizations, implement campaigns to advertise what the CIA does on campus. There's already been a little bit of that even kind of before the MOU came out. My dean, I'm the College of Arts and Sciences, actually brought students to Langley. He brought a group of interested students to Langley, and they took pictures in front of Langley with, I don't know what is so photogenic about Langley, but anyway, and then he actually also, when he was kind of doing public publicity for our college, arts and sciences, he would mention the CIA over and over again. And there was one example when a transgender colleague of mine, he was interviewing her, yes, that's a preferred pronoun, about kind of research. She was just hired. In the middle of the interview, he stopped and said, "You know, it's really great that we have transgendered people at our school. You know, I was taking students to the CIA and talking to people from the CIA, and it turns out they're really interested in getting transgender people involved too," which beyond the kind of problematic sort of, you know, all the other kind of gender-related problematic things there, it's just this kind of constant plugging of the CIA. So anyway, long story short, with the MOU, the idea is that they're going to set up this presence to recruit students, to get students to do simulations, to do research, quote unquote, they call it research, on campus. And again, this was in February of 2018 that this started. So in the process of gathering information, we did kind of a couple activities. I reached out to a colleague who, I found out in the meantime that the University of New Mexico, which has a huge kind of security studies program, was the also had a signature school. So I worked with colleagues from New Mexico to kind of find out what happened there and what they had done to kind of fight the signature school. And at that point, I found out that they had gotten the memorandum of understanding. I'm going to call it MOU. Is that okay? Just so I don't trip over my words. The MOU was not re-signed. It started, they had a 2017 MOU that was not renewed in 2018. They thought at that point. So I kind of got some strategies from them, worked with people at my college, worked with John, Sarah, and others from the PSC to kind of figure out what can we do. So at the faculty level at Baruch, we set up a faculty senate resolution that kind of stated our opposition to the CIA's presence on grounds ranging from, and I'm going to look, again, the general ethical problems of encouraging our students, or I don't know if protecting is too pejorative a word, but kind of letting the CIA have access to students from countries where the CIA might have actively led to, or the US military, to the students having to come to the United States. I had a student from Grenada, for example, who was very upset to hear this was happening. Number two, faculty research. The idea that if you're affiliated with the CIA and you're working in certain areas, it might be kind of, it might put you at risk in terms of getting a research visa. We had a colleague who worked in South Asia, and she was worried that she wouldn't be able to get her visa to do research if that happened. Breaking IRB protocol, that was another big concern, in the sense that the CIA was going to encourage students to do research. All research goes through the, I'm forgetting what IRB means, Institutional Review Board for ethical kind of assessment to make sure there's, to minimize damage to participants. None of that was going to happen with this. And number four, the screening process. If you're having a student getting involved in the CIA, as I hope none of us know, but we've heard, right, it's a very difficult, very invasive process of being interviewed to participate in this organization. So if students have an undocumented family member or anything like that, information's out there. They could get deported. They could have face other kinds of detentions, right? So, and then the fifth, and I think it's the fifth, and kind of for, and unfortunately, I think, for my colleagues at Baruch, the most offensive thing about all this was that faculty were not concerned, and it broke faculty governance guidelines and kind of protocol. And I mean, I'm not concerned in the sense that I believe in shared governance, but for a lot of faculty, as I'll talk about in a minute, there was this real kind of focus on my research, my school, not as much the students or the larger social implications, global implications of the process. Okay, so we had a faculty resolution passed. That was one thing. We had a teach-in that was co-sponsored, sponsored by the PSC chapter, and co-sponsored, I think, by the International Committee. We invited David Price, who is an anthropologist. He's the author of a really good book I'd recommend called Cold War Anthropology. And he's one of the founding members of the Network for Concerned Anthropologists. So he gave a talk along with Professor Johanna Fernandez from the History Department at Baruch about the legacy of the CIA, as well as different ways in the 1960s, 70s that actually there was pushback against the CIA. People like Philip Agee and kind of, it's a Church Report, I always forget, in the 1960s. Yeah, the Church Report. to kind of show students and other people in the audience that, you know, it's not like the CIA is something that we've all agreed on is a good thing. And it's not like it's just these radicals, these whatever you want to call them, cultural Marxists or whatever shit you want to say, who are like, have a problem with the CIA. There was a bunch of consensus not that long ago that the CIA was not something that we were okay with. And then we did a FOIL request, Freedom of Information Law request, to get more information about what they would be doing. And finally, we did very limited interviews with publications, really only The Village Voice. And so yeah, we kind of combined resolution. Oh, we did a resolution at PSC as well. So we combined kind of resolutions with educational activities. Those are really our main tactics. And I'm gonna kind of conclude by talking about what I think is wrong with some of those tactics. Maybe more should be emphasized over others. In terms of this question of using mechanisms of faculty governance as a way to kind of beat the CIA, make this argument that, you know, if Faculty Senate doesn't approve of this, then we're going to, you know, end the relationship. I forgot to mention it has to be renewed every year in August. So the Faculty Senate, a lot of my colleagues who are active in Faculty Senate, at part of our kind of ad hoc group, thought that Faculty Senate would be, you know, we could pass it to Faculty Senate and, you know, that would slow things down. It passed, I think, 25 or 24 to 2 among the presence, the senators at the Faculty Senate. And the president responded with, that doesn't represent faculty. That represents 24 people. So he literally said that publicly, and that was actually published in an interview, the interview in The Village Voice. So that didn't quite work. And what I thought seemed to be working, the times when we would, when we had the public event with David Price speaking and Johanna Fernandez, and we also had people flyering about the history of the CIA, what it did in El Salvador, what it did in certain country, right? Iran, Iraq, Guatemala. That was, as soon as that happened, the president issued a letter to all faculty saying, you know, we understand your concern, we're going to kind of reevaluate the MOU. So I would say, again, based on my sort of experience with this, that if we're going to create an opposition to the Central Intelligence Agency and what they're trying to do in an even more clandestine way than, say, the ROTC, we need to publicize the shit out of it. We need to do more media. We need to do more kind of educational activities around what the CIA is and what could be happening on our campus. Number two, we need to do a lot more kind of stakeholder analysis, power analysis of who besides the faculty at CUNY and the faculty at Baruch College where I teach could aid us in this fight. Throughout my kind of work on this ad hoc committee on campus, the faculty were over and over again at Baruch like, this is our problem. We don't want to have people paying attention to it because I don't want someone to Google me and see the CIA come up if we kind of make a big deal about this. So we need to make this a faculty governance issue. In January, I got an email from my colleague at New Mexico who'd been kind of coordinated their sort of resistance there. She said in this email, they had tried the same thing. Faculty governance, letter from the department, letters from faculty senate, resolutions from departments, resolutions from other kind of faculty bodies. She said, that failed us. We should have been doing more building up resistance, building up coalitions in the communities. We relied on faculty governance. We're told by an outgoing chancellor that because of the faculty's sort of the faculty's kind of resistance to this, that it would end. And that didn't happen. No one real outside of our faculty knew this was going on. So I think if we're going to kind of build a situation kind of similar to what Sophia was saying, that we really need to think about academics as not sort of confined to our college or not confined to even the university as our site of struggle, but really build up support through things like coalition building with activist organizations, with immigration groups, with anti-imperialist groups, with anyone we can kind of coordinate with to kind of put some heat under the administration who we can have no kind of, they have no reason to respond to faculty, which is at least in the context that I've found to be the case. If you say, if faculty say, we have a problem with this, they say, who cares? You know, we don't have to respond to that. So again, the only things that I found effective in the year we've been doing this were public activities, raising public attention, kind of turning the heat up. And we're kind of trying to rebuild what happened with the Faculty Senate resolution not being observed, with the MOU being renewed, with the news from New Mexico. That really left my colleagues at Baruch very beaten down. And this is in CUNY campus that in general is not very focused on faculty governance. The faculty governance, you know, we never see the, I don't know what it's like at CSI, but we've had an impossible time even seeing the budget at our college. So the faculty are beaten down and we're kind of licking our wounds, and some of us that are still kind of interested in this and don't feel like, you know, fuck it, nothing's gonna happen, are trying to kind of turn up the heat again. And yeah, that's where we're at. Cool. Thank you.
Thanks so much.